భద్రం కరణే తిష్యామదేవా భద్రం పశ్యేమాక్షుభిర్యజత్రా స్థిరైరంగైస్తువాగుంసస్తునూభిః యశేమ దేవహితం యదాయుః స్వస్తి న ఇంద్రో వృద్ధశ్రవాః స్వస్తి న పూషా విశ్వవేదాః స్వస్తి నస్తారక్షో అరిష్టనేమిః స్వస్తి నో బృహస్పతిర్దధాతు. ఓం శాంతి శాంతి శాంతి.
సో వి ఆర్ ఆన్ వర్స్ 28 ఆఫ్ ది కారిక చాప్టర్ 128. ప్రణవం ఈశ్వరం విద్యాత్ ప్రణవం ఈశ్వరం విద్యాత్ సర్వస్య హృది సంస్థితం సర్వస్య హృది సంస్థితం సర్వవ్యాపినిం ఓంకారం సర్వవ్యాపినిం ఓంకారం మత్వా ధీరో న శోచతి మత్వా ధీరో న శోచతి. ప్రణవం ఈశ్వరం విద్యాత్ సర్వస్య హృది సంస్థితం సర్వవ్యాపినం ఓంకారం మత్వా ధీరః న శోచతి. ప్రణవం, ప్రణవం ఇస్ ద నేమ్ ఫర్ ఓం. సో ద ప్రణవం అక్యూసేటివ్ సింగ్యులర్. హీ ఇండీడ్ ఈశ్వరం, ద లార్డ్ ఈశ్వర. విద్యా పొటెన్షియల్ థర్డ్ పర్సన్ సింగ్యులర్. Should one know, one should know, when one knows all of this, one should know the pranava, the om, as Ishwara. One should know that the pranava, which is Ishwara, sarvasya hridi samsitam, that pranava, which is Ishwara, is placed, is abiding, is residing, hridi, in the heart of all. Sarvasya, of all, hridi, in the heart, in the buddhi, of all. Sarvasya hridi samstitam. So one should know that the pranava Ishwara, which is abiding in the heart of everyone, of every being, okay? That om, which is Ishwara, which is abiding in each heart, in the heart of every being, itself is sarvavyapinam, is all-pervasive. Right? I'll tell you why this is so important, but sarva vyapinam. Vyapinam means it's pervading sarva all. Sarva vyapinam, pervading everything. It pervades everything. It's all pervasive. Omkaram matva, the one who knows, who has contemplated on, not just contemplated, has gained this knowledge, matva. So having gained this knowledge, the one who contemplates on, who recognizes it, the omkara, dhiraha na sochati, that dhiraha, that one who has this knowledge, who has that buddhi, that jnana nishtha, the dhira means that one who is thinks very clearly, who has that clear thinking, that so jnana nishtha, that dhiraha na sochati, doesn't grieve. Na sochati.
Doesn't what?
Grieve. For that person there is no sorrow. That person doesn't grieve. Okay? Whenever we say that the Om, which is Ishwara, remember Om is a name for Ishwara, so it has no independent, Om has no independent being, it's a Nama, right? It's the Nami, it's a Nama for the Nami, the thing which is being named, just like all names are. If I say chair, there's no such thing as a chair other than the object that it refers to. So chair is the name for a chair. By itself, It isn't anything. It's just a word denoting, right? So there's a very important relationship between the nama and the nami. And so since this Upanishad has revealed, really, spent the whole 12 verses revealing Om, the meaning of Om, as a name for Ishvara. And so in the revealing of what the Om means, so the A-U-M silence, the A-Matra, the U-Matra, the Makara, and the silence, in that unfoldment is an unfoldment of Ishvara. Right? Like if I'm unfolding. So that's why it's so important when we think of the when you think of Om, that that word has to, the word itself has to evoke the whole. The word should evoke Ishvara. And not just, it should evoke what Ishvara actually is. That's why when you say, if you say the word Ishvara, okay, the word Ishvara has different etymologies, but it's basically the one who controls, you know, the one who is the Lord, the one who is the master, ultimately, of all that is. So the one who is the Lord of all. That's what Ishvara means if we go to the etymology. Now I say to you, Ishvara, then what comes to your mind, if you know the etymology and you really know the meaning of the word, can just be the Lord. Okay? Because that's how we were trained, the Lord, Ishvara. Now the thing is, what we mean by Ishvara, there is so much teaching. And so now your definition of Lord, the Lord, or Ishvara, becomes filled by all of the teaching. Okay? And so, say, for instance, you were raised as in Judaism or in Christianity or in Islam, when you say the Lord, that's going to evoke something different. Right? But here when you say Ishvara, then because of all of the teaching, it should evoke Ishvara as Ishvara has been unfolded. But for Ishvara now, Ishvara has been given a name. The Lord has been given a name. And the name is that has been given is Om. And the reason that it has been given, Om has been given as the name, because the Mandukya Upanishad, the Upanishad itself, has, Swamiji will say, loaded this symbol with the whole vision. So that when you say Om, what comes to your mind is first the Remember, there's so many verses why being the very first sound and all of these things. The is equated to Ishvara, is equated to Virat, to the waking state, the waker in the waking state. So in the U is equated to the dream state, the dreamer in the dream state, and the Makara is equated to Prajna, to Ishvara, and the deep sleep state. And so, and the silence in between them is Brahman, because the Om, the Matra, the syllable rises out of silence and sets in silence. So if I say Om, 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 that silence is actually the Adhishtana. You know, it's the very basis, it's the very support from that is holding the mantra, the syllable. And so now, with all of this teaching, when you say now, Om, what would come to your mind, once this syllable has been packed, has been loaded with so much meaning, is as you say Om, you recognize Virat, the Ishvara as the whole waking state, the waker in the waking state, which means, for me, say as you say Om, the includes the waker and the waking state, right? And so, the waker and the waking state, immediately as I say that, this body, this physical body, the Vishwa, becomes part of Virat. As soon as I say the this physical body no longer belongs to me, the Atma, the self. This physical body is part and parcel of the waking state. So the waker belongs to the waking state, and I am the self of both the waker and the waking state. See what I mean? So the Atma now becomes the Adhishtana of the Akara, The Akara stands for Virat, and Vishwa, Virat means Ishwara in its physical form, and the individual, Waker, is part and parcel of that. And how do we recognize that really? Is when we go to the U, the Ukara, to the, which is the dream state. It's very simple there that the dream character is part of the dream world. And so when you think of the dream, you imagine the whole dream with the dream character in it. And so there, I am the self of the dream character who is in the dream. The dream character and the dream, say it like this, and the self of the dream, which includes the dream character. That should be very clear. But when I go to the, when I'm at the I should see that the includes the waking state in which the waker exists. So the waker, this waker is part and parcel of the waking state, and I am the self, really, of the waking state, which includes the waker. When I go to the U, I am the dream state, and I am the self of the dream state, which includes the dream character. When I go to the deep sleep state, then all duality is in avyakta, unmanifest condition. And I recognize that the jiva, what makes the jiva, the prajna, is really part of the Ishwara in unmanifest condition, which is the Maya Upadhi. You as a jiva are part and parcel, or your very being is part of Ishwara, and when Ishwara is in unmanifest condition, so are you. So in the dreams, when you go into the deep sleep state, if I were looking at that as Ishwara's pralaya, it's not at pralaya right now for when you as an individual go into the deep sleep state, but when you are in the deep sleep state, there is no difference, there is no subject-object differentiation, and that causal condition, we say, is the causal condition of Ishwara. Right? That's why that it's not just that prajna, the individual in the deep sleep state, we're not just looking at the prajna, we're looking at the causal condition of the creation, the avyakta. And so that causal condition, which is ajnanam for you, is really the causal condition of actually, how would you say it, unmanifest knowledge for Ishwara. You can understand, like, if you have an imagination, and in the imagination there's a lot of activity going on, it's your imagination after all, there's a lot of activity going on. When you bring that imagination into the avyakta, into unmanifest condition, which you can do it any time, right? So say I ask you to imagine the meadow with the people moving in it, all the kinds of things going on. You bring that meadow into avyakta, unmanifest condition. That unmanifest condition for you is just unmanifest knowledge. Right? It's unmanifest knowledge. But for the jivas within the imagination, it's unmanifest ajnanam. It's not unmanifest knowledge, it's unmanifest ajnanam. So what is knowledge for Ishwara, what is the Maya Upadhi, we'd say, when we talk about Ishwara, this Maya Upadhi that projects as the whole creation, that is manifest knowledge. Just like if you imagine your meadow, that's manifest knowledge for you. But for all of the ones in the imagination, they don't have any knowledge. They don't have a clue what's going on. For them, their only knowledge they have is what they're gaining through their sense perception and their mind. So they don't have knowledge. They enjoy the self, which is the self of Ishwara. They are made of the whole the Maya Upadhi. The Maya Upadhi, which makes this body, mind, sense organs, is the Maya Upadhi that makes the whole. The Atma, the Sat Chit of the whole imagination, you know, is the Sat Chit that each one of them enjoys. But they don't know that from their own standpoint. Right, because their knowledge as a jiva within the meadow imagination is only what they experience through their mind and sense organs. The mind is Maya, right? The mind is limited Maya. The sense organs are limited Maya. And so I have my mind, you have your sense organs, I have my sense organs. My sphere of experience is very different than your sphere of experience, even at this very moment. Because the angles are all different. The angles and also all of the multi-processing that's going on. So we all have very different experiences at any given time, and each experience is limited. Whereas for the one who projects the meadow, the whole thing, that person is, that one is projecting their meadow knowledge, right? Their unmanifest knowledge becomes manifest. Whereas those in the meadow, they all have limited knowledge. And so when the meadow goes into unmanifest condition, the ones who have limited knowledge now have, continue to have limited knowledge in unmanifest condition, okay? Limited knowledge is ajnanam, right? That's what we mean by avidya. If there was infinite knowledge, then there's jnanam, there's knowledge. There's no avidya, there's no ignorance there. But for everybody within the dream, so to speak, there is limited knowledge, and therefore ajnanam. Does that make sense? Now, we can use ajnanam here in two ways. There's ajnanam for Ishvara. For Ishvara, let's go back to the meadow. Ishvara is what we call sarvavit. Sarvavit means all particular knowledge. Your sarvavit, in reference to your dream or to your imagination, you have particular knowledge of the whole meadow, for instance. That's sarvavit. Ishvara also is what we call sarvajnaha, right? So sarvavit, sarvajnaha. If we put these two together, sarvajnaha means that for Ishvara, not only is there manifest knowledge of everything that's being experienced, there's also self-knowledge, because no ajnanam. The mityatva of the creation, my projection, is clear without words. No words are required because there's no limitation. The infinite nature of my own being is clear because no limitation, no ajnanam anywhere. And so Ishvara not only has infinite knowledge of the creation, also has self-knowledge, because nothing at all obstructing it. It would kind of be like you, it's not a perfect parallel by any means, but for you, in reference to your dream, your sarvavit, you have knowledge of everything going on in that dream because it comes from you, so it's a manifest knowledge for you, and you're also sarvajnaha. You have no sense that you recognize your own being in reference to the dream. The mityatva of the dream, the maya of the dream, it's a relationship of the maya dream or the maya projection to your own being. All of that is completely clear. There's no ajnanam there. But for the standpoint now, for the jiva, there's two ajnanams for the jiva within the dream or within the imagination. The one ajnanam is there's no sarvavit. In other words, the one in the dream looks around and only knows whatever the limits of your means of knowledge are. You know, you have limited sense perception and limited experience, so you have limited knowledge. You can never be sarvavit. You can never know the whole thing because your upadhi is limited. And if you're an ajnani, you also don't know yourself. Right? So this is the situation for an ajnani. In reference to the world, you have limited knowledge. Whatever can exist in time and space, limited knowledge. In reference to yourself, ajnanam. So ajnanam, ajnanam. In reference to yourself, ajnanam, because you take your mind, which is the vehicle for knowing anything really, takes your being to be itself. And then it takes itself to be your body and sense organs. And so the I has become one with this body, mind, sense organs through ajnanam. That's the ignorance that causes that adhyasa. So now we've got Ishvara, who's the sarvavit and sarvajnaha, right? All-knowing in terms of the creation, and also self-knowledge is there. That I am the self, the truth of all beings. Jiva, the ajnani jiva, certainly not a sarvavit. We say alpavit, only knows a little tiny bit. Alpa means just a little. It just knows limited knowledge. And in terms of sarvajnaha, there's no sarvajnaha. There's just bound by ajnanam. I am this body, mind, sense organs. That's for the ajnani. For the jnani, still, as a jnani means this body, mind, sense organs, you have knowledge, you still don't have sarvavit. Ishwara has sarvavit. The whole creation, right, shines as manifest knowledge. Everything that exists within time and space and every dimension is like one infinite vritti. The whole thing is known. The whole in totality, the whole thing is known. So Ishwara is still the sarvavit. You still are the alpavit. Because you still, your knowledge of the world is still limited by your mind and sense organs. By the fact that you have a limited mind and sense organs. That remains. And you go on accruing knowledge and chipping away at your agnanam in reference to the world. But the sarvajnaha is there for the jnani. And the sarvajnaha is the same. Ishwara sarvajnaha, your sarvajnaha, is the same in the self, in the sense of knowing what is the truth of the whole thing. Both sarvajnaha and sarvavit mean all knowledge. But sarvavit means all particular knowledge. Sarvajnaha means you know the truth of the whole thing. The truth of the whole thing is that Chidananda, the conscious being, the me that you are, you recognize as the self of all. That's sarvajnaha. So in fact, what's the difference between you and Ishwara in reference to self-knowledge? There is no difference at all, because the nature of the self is only one. Right? If the nature, if Ishwara had a big giant self, big giant Satchitananda, and you have just a little one, then that's different. But Satchitananda, the nature of your being, right, is only one. So that in total, the me that is your own self-experience is the exact self-experience of Ishwara and of Tibi and of the worm. It makes no difference, because from your being, there's no dimension, there's no time, there's no space, there's no extension. So the me that you are is exactly the me that Ishwara is, and is the me that is the Adhishtana, the very basis of every experience that exists. Every perception, every mental cognition, you know, the whole creation in total, the sattva running through the whole creation is one infinite vritti. And then all of the jivas have their little vrittis, you know. All manifest knowledge has for its basis, for its being, only the satchit, which is me, which is the pratyagatma. So at the very beginning, you know, of this Upanishad, he says, you know, just listen to this. It's so nice, because especially after we've done all of this and you go back. The very beginning he says, Om iti etad aksharam idam sarvam. He says, this syllable, aksharam, the syllable om, is etad sarvam. It is all of this. This syllable om is etad, this aksharam, this syllable, is etad sarvam. It is everything. It is everything. Then he says, Tasya upavyakyanam, we are going to expound upon this. And then what does he say? Bhutam bhavat bhavishyat iti sarvam omkara eva. This omkara is everything that existed in the past. Bhutam, bhavat, everything that exists now. And bhavishyat, anything that comes in the future. This is Om. And then he says, Yetcha anyat trikalatitam, that also. He says, and that which exists beyond all of that, beyond these three periods of time, that also is Om. There is nothing that is not Om. He starts with that. Then he says, Sarvam hietad Brahma. He says, and all of this is Brahman, is infinite being. Brahman is the self which is infinite. So, and all of this is Brahman. And he says, Ayam Atma, for so, all of this is Brahman. Then he says, Ayam Atma. This self is Brahman. So he says, all of this is Atma. All of this is Brahman. This self, this Atma, this is Brahman. Right? Then he says, and this Atma, it has four padas. It has four padas, four quarters, you know, as though four parts. And then he goes and tells what each part is. The first part, so four padas, the first part, we can divide it in like into four quarters, not say four padas, quarters. This Atma, this me, which is Brahman, which is everything, it has four quarters, four padas. The first one is this waking state. The waking state includes the waker, and then he says, as the Bahishpragnaha, the one who sees everything through the sense organs externally, then he says, this one, this waker, is also Vishvirat. So the first pada for the self, which is Brahman, is this waker, who is also Ishvara, the waking state, Virat. Okay? And then he goes, that's the akar. He'll say later it's the akar. And then he says, the second pada is the dream state. And the dream state includes both the waker, the dreamer, Tajasa, and Hiranyagarbha, the dream state. Then he says the third pada is the deep sleep state. The deep sleep state is only the, when everything becomes absolutely unmanifest, just a mass of consciousness, you know. And that one is both the Prajna and Ishvara. That's the deep sleep state. And then after having said all of that, he then goes and talks about all of this, and then he does some verses, and then he goes into that which is, so we've done three, waking, dream, and deep sleep, these four padas. And then he says, with this final verse, he goes in and he says, the fourth pada, that pada is to really be known as the Atma. And that pada, that fourth pada, is free of the waking state, and free of the dream state, and free of the deep sleep state. And that one is where the whole creation results. So it's a very famous verse. He's gone through all of these padas. I'm just doing it very briefly here, but he's gone through all of these padas, you know, and said, and now we'll go on having said, because he starts out saying, Om is everything. He says, Om is everything. Then he goes to and says, Om is Brahman. Brahman is Atma. Atma has four quarters. And then they go through explaining all this, waking, dream, deep sleep. So yes, I have all these experiences. You mean that my being also, I have these four quarters, but actually it's only the Atma, the fourth quarter, which has to be free of all of these. If the fourth quarter wasn't free of all of these, then I couldn't be the self of the other three, right? Because the waking state is negated by the dream state, which is negated by the deep sleep state, yet I'm the self of all of them. If I'm the self of all of them, then I can't belong to anyone. So the fourth pada is the Atma, is the self which is Brahman, which is the Adhishtana, you know, the truth of all of the other three. The other three negate each other. And yet, negating each other, I remain the same as the self of all three. And so, having gone through this, now he goes back to this Omkara, saying that, okay, now this is the reality of the Atma. You have these four padas, and this sacred syllable, Om, you know, identifies itself as having four matras, each one belonging to one of the padas. So the Amatra belongs to the waking state. The Umatra belongs to the dream state. The Makara belongs to the deep sleep state. And the silence, the Amatra, Amatra means there where there is no mantra, that silence belongs, as it indicates the Atma. And so, having gone through this, first going through all of the four padas for Ishvara, Virat, the waking state, dream state, you know, Hiranyagarbha, Ishvara is the deep sleep state and the causal condition for Ishvara. Okay. Having gone through all of that, and then having gone through and unfolded for you the Om as A-U-M, and how that all relates to the waking dream and deep sleep and the silence. Now he says, now should you know, one should know now, that the Pranava, which is the sacred silk name for Om, that Pranava is a name for Om, one should know that this Pranava is indeed Ishvara. And it imbibes that Om, that Ishvara, which is Om, or Om, which is Ishvara, because Nama Nami, right? This Om, which is Ishvara, abides here in my heart, in the Buddhi. It abides in my Buddhi. Okay? And it is all-pervasive. It abides in my Buddhi, and it is all-pervasive. So now, when you say that, it abides in my Buddhi, but it is all-pervasive, that means from the standpoint of this Maya Upadhi, right, this body, mind, sense organs, this mind, which has taken itself, the mind has taken itself to be me, right, which is true. The mind is me, the body is me, right, the deep sleep state is me, but I am the self of all three. And these three negate themselves. They negate each other. The waker waking state is negated by the dreamer dream state, is negated by the deep sleep state. So even though all three enjoy me, I am free of all three. See what I mean? This is the satyam mitya. The whole unbiased vyatireka is this. If I can say, when this is, I am, and when this is not, I still am. I am free of whatever that is. So now if I say, do you understand that? Like if I say, when this is, that is, when this is not, that is not, then there's a dependence. The one has to be there in order for the other. But here, that's not so. The unbiased vyatireka doesn't work. When this is, that is, when this is not, I still am. So if we put this into the language of in this situation, when the waking state is, I am. When the dream state is, which negates the waking state, okay? When the waking state is, so I can say when the waking state is, I am. When the dream state is, which has negated the waking state, I still am. Okay? Therefore, I can't be the waker in the waking state. I've never been identified with the whole waking state. I'm only identified with the waker in the waking state. But really, it's the waker and the waking state itself. The waker is part and parcel of the waking state that is negated by the dream state. So the one who is the self of the waker in the waking state is the self of the dreamer in the dream state. But that self can't be identified as the body-mind-sense organs of the waker or as the body-mind-sense organs of the dream character in the dream state. Because those two are totally dependent upon the experience of the waking state or the dream state. So the me that is the adhishtana, the truth of both of them, has to be absolutely free of all of those attributes for me to so comfortably be the self of both and present to both experiences. And then to be, for me to claim the deep sleep state as my deep sleep, I slept so well last night, where there's no subject-object duality, there's no type of talking or chit-chat going on, there's no acknowledgement of myself sleeping when I'm deep sleeping. I take on that too. It's my sleep. From the standpoint of the waker, right? From the standpoint of the waker, you identify with you take on the dreamer, it's my dream, and you take on the deep sleeper, it's my deep sleep. So who is there present in all three of those states? That one is the adhishtana. That one is the truth, the one that is pervasive to all those three, but that one can't take on any attributes of any of the three, right? Or the one will be negated by the other. So that chatushpat really of the four of these four padas, there's a little difference in their order of reality. The waker, dreamer, deep sleeper are dependent for their being on the Atma, the self, which is the self of all of them. So the fourth pada is free of the other three. It's the self of the other three. Waker, dreamer, deep sleeper. It's the self of the other three. It's also free of the other three. That's why you make it four, right? It's pervasive to the other three, but it's also free of the other three. That's the whole satya mitya. So now, when he says, the one who knows this omkara, know this om, the omkara, as abiding in your heart. It's situated there in the buddhi, and yet it's all pervasive. So situated in the buddhi is from the standpoint of what? It's from the standpoint of the buddhi, right? Not from the standpoint of the self. It's just like I am the self. I, in the waking state, I am the self that the buddhi, you know, that my mind identifies with. Mind identifies with me. The mind-body complex identifies with me in the waking state, right? But when I'm in the dream state, that one who had identified with me is not there. That body, mind, sense organs that identified with me in the waking state is not there in the dream state. We have another body, mind, sense organs identifying with me. And so, yes, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, I'm abiding there in the buddhi. If I wasn't abiding in the buddhi, then the buddhi wouldn't mistake itself for me. And so I become the buddhi, you know, the intellect, the mind becomes the place where the self can be realized, as opposed to a chair that doesn't have a buddhi or sukshma sharira. So from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, the buddhi is what reflects me, where I can be found, where I manifest. But this one who is identified with, from the standpoint of the buddhi, is the self which all buddhis identify with. So just think in this room, if this room were a dream, for instance, we've got 10 buddhis in this room, 10 minds in this room, and each buddhi is enjoying, identifying with the one self. So it's not the chair, or it's not the clothes, or it's not the body that's identifying with the self. What I mean by that is your mind, if your mind is using your sense of touch to pervade this physical body, then you'll identify this body with the self, because the mind using the sense organs and sense of touch enlivens this body. A dead body is not enlivened like that. Or if you're a paraplegic, say if you lost your sense of touch from the waist down, if you close your eyes, your sense of self stops there. It doesn't extend, right? So the extension or identification of the body with the body requires your sense perception to feed that information into your mind for you to identify with it. Right? And so the mind is what really is the receptacle for this type of identification. It identifies through the sense organs with the body, right? And then from its own standpoint, with whatever vrittis are there, even the ahankara, it identifies that with the Atma. So the Atma is there, illumining the mind, but must be free of mind in order to illumine the dream, and must be free of subject-object in order to be the self of the deep sleep. And so that self, from the standpoint of the buddhi, becomes as though limited, but from the standpoint of itself, has no limitation at all. If it had any limitation in the waking state or dream or deep sleep state, it would be stuck there, because those qualities would belong to it. And if those qualities belong to it, when the deep sleep, when the dream, when the waking state is in unmanifest condition, then so are you. Then you can't be the self of the dream. You can't be the one who is present in the deep sleep state. It's not possible, because you're gone. When the waking state goes, when the identification with the body, mind, sense organs goes, you know, if that is you, when this is, that is, when this is not, that is not, then you are gone. And you know what? You are gone. Your body, your mind, your sense organs, the ahankara, all of your experiences, everything that you have taken to be you in a nice little bundle, all of that is gone. What isn't gone, and the only thing that isn't gone, is me. The me that is the self of the dream. The me that is the conscious being, which is not objectifiable, which is actually free of any type of attributes at all, other than its own being. That's why when I was saying, when we were doing the meditation, if you just relax, it's really all you have to do. If you just relax to get rid of the clutching and the identification, the relaxation, no matter what is going on. In fact, it's such a good exercise to practice all the time, actually. Whenever your mind clutches in any way, just let it do what it's doing and you just simply relax. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about what it's doing. Don't worry about what it's feeling. Let it be. Do all of that. Don't even push it away. Nothing. Just breathe into it and you just relax. Yeah. And then another wave will come. You just let it be. Don't push it away. You just relax. Relaxation, like the clear water bucket, you know, it removes the trauma of whatever the thought is. It removes the anxiety, the trauma, the affect, the hurt, the whatever kind of emotional trauma is going on there. As you relax, it's like a water bucket clearing, the mud settling down and all of the agitation settling down. And then it will reflect whatever thought is there. It's fine. But the thought's not problematic. It can be, you can have, say you have the worst enemy who's caused you so much misery and pain, done so many things to just make a mess out of your life. And we all have somebody usually. some kind of thing or situation there, you know. And so you can evoke that image, but your mind can be so conditioned to that image creating a fear or hatred or anger. You know? It doesn't have to be a person. It could be anything. You know? Be a situation. That an image, that very thought creates so much angst. What you do is you just allow that thought to be there and breathe in and out. Just let the mind relax. The mind is the instrument which is having the thought. So you let the instrument relax. You know, and let the body relax. So that then the instrument becomes like, it just becomes like a clear slate of, you know, lake, like a very clear lake. Then just breathe into it. And then why do all this? Well, first of all, just to understand the mithyatva of the mind. To understand that these emotions and feelings and traumas can turn on a dime. It just requires you to just let go and relax. Emotions have no deeper meaning than that. They create tension in the mind, which creates a lot of hurt and angst. And so as you relax that, then what? Then like in the Taittiriya Upanishad, it's so beautiful, you just let your mind dive into your being. Just relax, ego, just to take it a different level, just to relax into your own presence. And then the question, you know, what am I like? What is this me? What am I like? You have the contours of the body, the physical feelings of the physical body don't really disturb that. You know, the released thoughts in your mind don't cause any problem for you to just recognize who you are. And then just notice who you are. What are you like? What is your being? What is this being that's the self of the dreamer, the self of the deep sleeper, the self that is always there? What are you like? And then you ask yourself, I didn't take it this far today, but we will. Why do the Upanishads refer to me as Ananda, or as the beloved, or as that which is the most dear? And you just see, you ask yourself, is there anyone, anything that is more dear than me? It sounds kind of, selfish or egotistical or something, but it isn't. You're getting to the truth of all beings. It's not just the truth of you. You're getting to the truth of all beings, which is the truth of you. And then when you realize that, what it means, that Ananda means, they're not meaning joy states, bliss states of mind. They're meaning the one who is always present, the one who is you, the one who has, there is no distance from you and any thought or any feeling or any experience that you have. You're the self of whatever the experience is. So, whatever the experience is can, once you know yourself, the experience, whatever it is, even an agitated one, I'm just doing this relaxation one because it makes it so obvious to you. But once you really know, it doesn't matter what the state is. Your mind can be tense as anything, and it's not away from you. You are not tense when your mind is tense. You are not hurt when your mind is hurt. And this can be differentiated. When you are afraid, yourself is not afraid. And so the mind learns to take your being as its refuge at all times. It's like the pot taking the clay, taking refuge in the clay. Your being, your mind takes refuge at all times in you because you are the stable one. You are the stable one that is full and whole and complete. No matter what, nobody can do anything about it. You can't do anything about it. Your emotions can't do anything about it. Nothing can do anything about it. The relaxation exercise is such a powerful exercise because you don't have to suffer. If you learn this, you don't have to suffer because your mind is used to suffering and used to responding and reacting. And you can teach it to relax when it does that. Just you welcome in the situation or whatever it is, and you just sit there with it. Let it relax. You don't have to change your thoughts. You just let them relax. And then in that act, it becomes like the clear water bucket, and your being overwhelms, whatever the thoughts are. They lose their power. They don't, it's not that you're emotionally bypassing or anything like that, or trying not to have feelings or thoughts. It isn't that. It's that you're allowing all those things to be, but you relax them into yourself. And so they get, the anxiety and the tension gets discharged. So here, when one is able to do that, you recognize what becomes more and more clear to you, that being that you are, right, which you are, which the mind is enjoying, you realize its own, your own presence. And as you start to see something, you realize that this me that you are, it isn't contained by the mind. It has nothing. See, this is another tricky thing. When we say it isn't contained by the mind, and then we use things like all pervasive, like space, you maybe want to have an experience of yourself all of a sudden pervading the room. Now all of a sudden your being becomes all pervasive like space, all of a sudden you're pervading the room. It is true that you're pervading the room, but not like space in an objectified way. I'm aware of space. Right? And I'm aware of space pervading the room. But I pervade space. Space exists in me. And so from my own standpoint, I recognize the kind of the experience is that my being, from its own standpoint, is not only not contained by this mind. It is not contained, period. It's not contained. It's not contained by the universe. It's not contained by anything. It is free in and of itself. It's not big and it's not small. It's just that there's nothing else. And so there's no dimension there for you to be big or small. These words don't apply. But the self that you are is free unto itself. From the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi, from this mind, it becomes, from its own standpoint, this is myself. Right? The mind says, this is myself. And actually it is itself, because the Maya has no self, has no existence apart from me. But from my own standpoint, it's not that I'm pervading anything. But there is nothing that's away from me. And so when we say the self that's abiding in the buddhi is all-pervasive, you have to be careful that you don't think of all-pervasive in terms of it pervading the dimension of the creation. It's rather that this creation, this whole creation, has no being apart from me. It has no self. It has no existence apart from me. And I am the non-dual being which it enjoys. I'm not big or small. I'm free of space. So if I'm free of space and time, I'm not big or small. These words don't apply. But this being that I am is the being which the whole creation enjoys. See what I mean? It's not that I've stretched out to become the creation. It's that the whole time-space creation enjoys me. And so it's important. I don't know if these words are working for you, but the thing is, it's important because this me in total that I am, that is free from dimension, I am the being of all that is. And so I am in total right now, Ishwara. Even though this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara, right? And so this, you wouldn't say this body is Ishwara. Well, you should say it's Ishwara, and that it is of only Ishwara, but it's a part of Ishwara. But the me that is the self of this body, which is free of time and space, is the very me that is the self of the whole creation. That's why in the whole second chapter, what they're going to be doing in the second chapter of this is working with this mithya. So to really understand it, it's very simple. You just give yourself a big imagination, this me, and then imagine a giant meadow, or imagine a universe. A universe is a big imagination. You're the self of that imagination. You don't become big or small. It's that there is nothing but you, and everything that is has you for its being. And that's the whole vision of the Vedanta. And so here he says, you know, having understood this omkara, the dhiraha, the one who sees it, the buddhi, the one who has the buddhiman, the one who has the buddhi, this knowledge, and the sochati, that person doesn't grieve. There is no grief. Because there is no grief for the Atma. And the grief that the mind may go through, or the things, the grief, it's what is going on in the universe, in the mithya. Your mind might have some grief, but that mind is mithya. Just relax and it goes away. Atma, your being, has no grief. It's not possible. Satchitananda, conscious being, the me that you are, is always the same. It is the beloved, but it's not a bliss state. It is the most dear, but not as a bliss state, as its very swarupa. And that wholeness that I am illumines, you know, joy and grief and sorrow and agitation and shanti. It illumines everything equally. But the me that is there doing all this illumining, not as an action, but just as its very swarupa, that me is fine. And I'm always fine. And so I'm so fine that any amount of sorrow or agitation can dive into me and be cleansed without myself becoming polluted. You know? Like, say you have a beautiful ocean and you keep throwing crap into it, it becomes polluted. But the Atma is the greatest purifier. It's called of all the purifiers, the Atma is the greatest purifier because it can take any infinite amount of whatever the creation has to pull, to give, and nothing happens to it at all. You know? That's why the mind, the more your mind gets to know yourself, the more in love it is, the more it falls in love, because yourself is always there for you. Your very nature is always there for you. It will not, cannot, it's incapable of letting you down. It's incapable of changing its nature. And so it's not fickle. You know? All you need to do, it's not going to change its mind on you. It's not going to fall out of love, you know. No, I'm sorry, I don't love you anymore. The only thing that's like that, you know, the only thing. Everything else, you know, is Maya, I mean, it's in duality. Things change. You don't. And since the nature of being is that there's nothing more beloved once that's seen. It's not just an intellection. It's something to recognize. Recognition of that is one of those aha moments. It's an aha moment. It's the recognition. It's kind of like, I really am the beloved, that's really exactly what this being is, that there is nothing more dear, and it's not some blissy thing, you know, some exalted bliss state, bliss thing that you're supposed to, that you equate with enlightenment. It isn't that at all. It's something that is here right now, and that is so much more beloved than any bliss state. But it doesn't have these bells and whistles. That's why you miss it. But once you get it, once you recognize it, it doesn't compare. There's no comparison with any type of state that would even compare. Well, should I have a bliss state or myself? You would never say, "Oh, I'll take the bliss state." No, I'll take me. Thank you. Yeah. I will always win. I will always win. Yeah, for sure. That's the thing. You know, so you have to get that. You have to understand it. What is the most profound is hidden in its simplicity. What is the most exalted is hidden in the profundity of its simplicity. You can't even say profundity of the simplicity, because the simplicity hides the profundity of it. So that's why, you know. Such a beautiful thing. So Dhiraha na Shochati, the one who recognizes this, there's no grace. Everything else is mitya except for you. Yeah. And that's not to derail this or the beauty of it or the beauty of Ishvara. It's just that the truth, you are the truth of the whole thing. And the presence or absence of the creation doesn't matter. Actually, it doesn't matter. Like, if you wake up from a dream, nothing has really happened. If you were to wake up from the creation, nothing has happened. Because what is the truth of the creation is your own being. See what I mean? So this has really the same order of reality as the dream from the standpoint of your being. So we'll do the last verse next. Last verse of this chapter next week. Purnamida, Purnamidam, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
You know, there's a, in this process of the mind diving into the self or finding refuge there, that's different than telling the mind to do that. You know, there's a separation there.
You just let, you let it do that because you can, see the thing is, like even with that whole idea of relaxation and non-clinging, you're the only, that's all you're doing. You're not telling the mind to not think.
Oh.
Or to think this way and not that way, or feel this way and not feel that way. You're not doing anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but you are doing something. What you are doing is relaxing. You're relaxing your mind. That's different than trying to control the mind.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? Yeah, you can tell it to relax. You just let it relax. You don't have to use words. You just let it relax. You're not telling it what to think, right? Or what to feel. You're not doing that. You're letting it, no matter what it's thinking or what it's feeling, you're letting it relax. So in a way, we're not used to doing that. We're used to letting the thoughts. The thoughts themselves dictate, or the thoughts produce the feeling, right? But actually, what we often don't recognize is that it's the tension in the mind that is producing the feeling, you know, not the thought. You can have the same thought about a person or a situation or something that can be upsetting. You have exactly the same thought, and you're not upset at all. You're happy, you're fine, absolutely fine.
Would you say it's our thought about the thought?
It
has to come from...
Yeah, it's the thought about the thought, the rotating around the thought. But what I'm saying is that if you learn how to even, say the thought is kind of perseverating, it's going around and around and around, let it do that. All you do is relax. You know, and then that actually kind of changes the interest of the mind in perseverating, you know, going around and around. You know what that means, right? It means it's a psychology term. When there's something bothering you, and the mind just thinks about it all, from every angle, circling around, certainly, you know. Ah, thanks, Chuck. Circling around, you know. But when you just let it do that, that's why I'm saying don't so much worry about the feeling or the perseverating, the, you know, of the mind. All you do is let it be there, don't push it away, and you just relax. And relax means it's almost like letting the mind, like if you were to let a muscle relax or let the brain relax. You just let your mind relax, no matter, without worrying about what it's thinking. You know? And then sometimes it helps to use your breath to breathe in and out, you know, of the worrisome thought. But the trick is what's so powerful, I think, is to not think that you have to, don't worry about the thoughts or the perseverating or the emotion. Let it be there, but welcome it, and then you just relax and relax and relax without telling the thought to do anything. And just relax and relax and relax. And what happens is the thought then becomes thin. It loses kind of its it's substantial, it's substance somehow. And what becomes much more dominant is just your own presence. And then you can, as you become more familiar with yourself, the mind starts to use you in a sense, in a positive way, to always be with you. It falls in love with you because of the wholeness of your being. It falls in love with that, you know? And all problems it takes to me. It brings home to me. And that's why the self doesn't, can absorb the whole universe. It can absorb the entire universe without any problem at all, I think. So it can certainly absorb and refresh whatever problems that you may have. Nothing happens to being itself. And so the mind has a sanctuary. Your being is the sanctuary for all of your experience, you know. And if there's ever anything going on in your mind, you know, your mind gets freaked out or hurt or agitated or angry or whatever, just learn how to just let it be and just relax. Just relax it without worrying about what you're thinking about. You don't have to negate what you're thinking about. What you're thinking about can be true. I mean, the situation could be really bad, you know, or the person could be a jerk or whatever. Or not. It's not a comment on the reality, the myth of the mitya, mm-hmm. of the vyavahara. It's just how you are in it.
If I may, relative to that, the letting go of the changes, the mityatvam of the dream state, we can do that when we wake up. There's a seemingly a different relationship to the challenges of the virat, the empirical physicality of the body.
What you have to think of it like is like this.
Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely.
While we can readily let go of the dream state changes, the enjoyer of the virat is experiencing something challenging.
No.
Or
it's a little bit different. Say when you're in the dream state, the dream character in the dream state could have a very challenging situation, right? And they're going to be experiencing the dread or fear or anger or whatever it is of that very challenging situation, right? Unless that dream character knows how to relax or has knowledge in such a way that they can relax in that situation. So the dream character is kind of, they also need a dream guru. When you wake up from the dream, as the waker, you can have all this objectivity and you go and recognize the whole thing's just a dream, and you know that guy shouldn't have been gotten so, could have you know just relaxed and been fine. But that's from the standpoint of the waker. From the standpoint of the dream character, that dream character needs a guru or just has to wait for you to wake up, right? But from his standpoint or her standpoint, they can suffer any type of anxiety or trauma or get into terrible, very frightening situations. And usually it'll wake you up, you know. So those dream characters suffer within the dream like we suffer here. But now here, the thing is, here we can look back and appreciate the mityatva of the dream, right? It's not so easy for us to appreciate that here when we are in the dream, in the waking state. That's the same situation that the dream character is in the dream state. So here there's some teaching, a lot of teaching that has to take place for you to realize that actually my being is the self of the whole thing. But and then also to learn like what I'm talking about now with this like this meditative experience, these meditative techniques. As you gain this knowledge, these meditative techniques are very meaningful, but they're even meaningful without this knowledge. You just don't know why it works. You know? I can help my clients and you know, with these kind of relaxation things. But for us, there's much more understanding, and because yourself is there as its very self and is free, is ananda. your mind is mitya, you know. Emotions are caused by stress, by the tensing of the mind. You can practice relaxation, relaxing the mind. You can get to know the invariable of your invariable self, you know. So all of that becomes just a way of helping the mind as it matures in this knowledge to let go of tensions that don't need to be there.
When you do that,
yeah,
and then it sounds like there's almost a second step. There's the relaxing into the thoughts, the perseverating or the obsessing, as colloquially it's sometimes called, and then relaxing into presence sounds like a different thing. Does that happen naturally?
Well, for somebody, so you know, well, you've been doing this for, you understand it, and you have that knowledge, all that is clear. It's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because yourself, for a jnani, as you become at home with your vision, yourself is the constant always. That never varies at all. You know, it doesn't make any difference what the experience is. That experience is taking place in your being, which is always exactly the same. So that's a given. That takes some time, right? Until the mind is clear and, you know, multi-level doubts are resolved and all of that. But what happens is that your own presence is the constant. Now, say there's perseverating or some hurts or pains or some things have happened that cause the mind to have a reaction or to be angry or whatever it is, to be hurt, you know, to be depressed, to be afraid, whatever, these emotions that that are hurtful to us. Once you understand the world, as the more you understand the mityatva of the mind, or the maya nature of the mind, and its relationship, what creates pain in the mind, all the different varieties of pain, there are many different nuances of pain. Hatred, anger, anxiety, jealousy, the whole negative spectrum of emotion.
All those are shukshma. And like, yeah. Upon contemplation, thoughts can evanesce. And anxiety,
yes,
jealousy,
yeah. Yeah,
anger,
yeah, yeah.
Can evanesce.
Yeah.
But the empirical physicality of birat, which isn't shukshma,
yeah. Yeah, that, oh, I
that
see
is
what you mean.
Still experienced.
That's right.
And in my mind, doesn't evanesce.
It doesn't, like, for instance, if
bad thoughts can, you know.
That's true. You're saying, like, for instance, if the body is ill, the body is ill, you know, and you do what you can to help it and to kind of relax into the pain in whatever ways work to mitigate the physical pain of the body. But that's something that, as long as we have a body, we all have to go through that.
I guess still the attitude about that physical discomfort that is undeniable and will not evanesce, the presence in there shifts. I still, you know, I see that.
The presence of your being, of your mind.
Well,
with
the
it.
Thought about the discomfort.
Yeah, the thought about the discomfort and also the emotional discomfort in reference to the discomfort. But yeah, absolutely, physical illness is physical illness. And your attitude toward it and the way you hold it, I think, mitigates it to some degree, but doesn't get rid of it, you know. Even Swamiji told me once, you know, he has had all these bypasses and all these heart problems. And at one point, when they were trying to do some sort of a preparation for a bypass, they nicked his valve in his heart. And so he started bleeding profusely. So they had to crack open his chest, go in there and catch the, right away they had, you know, and they had to catch the artery that had been cut and all of that. And the he said that the physical pain that he went, that what that caused him was so severe, that was so much, that he goes, I almost lost my objectivity. But I mean, that's the point, you know. I mean, we can have terrible pain. And that's why, I mean, the body is capable of terrible pain, and you know, everybody's going to have their own life and their own death. You know, some people get to just drop dead. Like my father's neighbor was so old, and he was out there all active his whole life and was out there rototilling, and he just dropped dead. My father was a doctor, and he saw the whole thing happen, and he went over and, you know, took care of the situation. Yeah. Another guy, Swamini Premananda, she used to be Sunita, and her father, one night, on a very auspicious evening, astrologically, totally unexpected, he died in his sleep. He just didn't wake up. Yeah. So that's all considered punya. You know, we all have our own death to deal with, you know, and it comes when it comes. But when it comes, it's here. You know, you could be, that's the amazing thing. Just like any situation that you've had, all the situations you've had up till right now don't count in terms of right now, in a sense. Because right now is what is happening. And when you're ill, I think maybe many of us have had situations, and I certainly have, probably because of my trips to India, situations where we're actually very, very ill. You know, and that is a game changer. There's something that really has to be dealt with there. You know? And then you have to work with yourself. You know, there's a lot of revelations, at least for me, the times I've been really sick, and once when I was certain I was dying, actually, and I was about 32 or so. It changes your orientation toward everything. Changes. But one thing I noticed was that the saving grace of the whole thing, what made everything kind of beautiful in its own way, you know, was this knowledge and Ishwara. Because you realize, one realization I had, and I was really happy that I had it too, it meant a lot to me, was I realized that as a jiva, my real relationship was to Ishwara. Whether I'm here or on a different loka or wherever I am, my relationship is to Ishwara, you know. And then I used to walk around, because I was really sick, and I was sick for such a stupid reason, but nobody could find out what the reason was. The reason was I was hyperventilating, but not in a way that you could tell. You know, nobody could hear it or anything, but it was throwing out off the blood gas in such a way that made me very, very sick for a couple of years. When they found the problem, I was cured within like 15 minutes, but it went on for all of these years. And so I remember walking around, and I had that, it was of great comfort to me. I realized that I belong here as long as I'm here, but where I belong to Ishwara. You travel as a jiva, you travel, but this is only your home right now. The whole universe is your home, because just think, this is one life of an infinite number of lives, so you've been traveling a lot more than you've been here. So this is, and I used to get such comfort in that, and then realize really that that's where my Shraddha was, and that was where my devotion was, and my real attachment was, and I started shedding attachment here. And I think I was shedding any kind of attachment here because I wasn't going to stay. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me that I wasn't. I was just too sick, you know. And so there's all of these things take place in their own kind of very interesting way. But for us, even gaining this knowledge, it's even a deeper level than that. I knew that I would, you know, travel in the universe, where be wherever I was supposed to be, with it as part of Ishwara, you know. But there's part of you that doesn't travel. Atma doesn't travel. The me that you are is just the me that you are, period. The universe can be here or not be here. It's totally irrelevant to what is the truth of what is here is just me. Me means the Atman, the self. That is what is actually here. It's like the, you know, the clay pot. What is really there is the clay. And the pot is, in a sense, irrelevant to the clay. What is really here is me, the self. And this is nothing but the self. It's nothing but that. We see this huge, incredible display. It's incredible. There's no words for what this is. But what it is me, you know, in terms of what is actually here. And for the Jivan Mukta, you know, if your knowledge hasn't completed itself, you'll travel and pick up the thread, you know, in your next birth. But if the knowledge has completed itself, then you just abide as Ishwar. There's no more Jivatvam. Even now there's no Jiva there because there's the self that you are is Brahman. You don't have this superimposition of where you're taking yourself to be your body, mind, sense organs. You are you, and that you is Brahman. And so when this body drops off, there's no one to not be, who wants to not be you. You know? There's just that type of desire is not there anymore.
And so it's the jiva that causes that reincarnation, actually.
The ajnanam, yeah.
The ajnanam.
Yeah. It is.
Or the sankalpa.
The sankalpa, yeah, the sankalpa born of ajnanam. Or say you have a sankalpa, like say you think, for whatever reason, so we won't say for a jnani, they have a sankalpa, let me have one more birth. They've got that sankalpa to do that. That means there's something holding the jivatvam together. See what I mean? There can come a time when that's a kind of sankalpa, there's no reason for it. But if the sankalpa is there, you have a reason for it, and that's good enough. You know, the bodhisattva vow. You can have that type of a sankalpa, you have that sankalpa, okay. But there's a reason for that sankalpa, and I'm saying there does come a time when there's no reason for that sankalpa. But as long as there's a reason for it, you can have it.
The question I was asking before, I think you answered it in terms of the yoni.
Yeah.
But what about the one who's not a yoni? When you're doing this relaxation and you relax into the thoughts, or you relax...
The stress will still go away.
So the stress goes away. And then relaxing into presence, is that something that happens naturally? Is that something... You're telling us, you know, that during the guided meditation. So if we're not quite there yet...
It doesn't necessarily happen naturally if you don't know that a presence to differentiate from your own mind. So there may not be a focus on it, you know. But I'm asking you to focus on something that we've been teaching. And so then you know that there's something, there's a shift of focus.
For me, what comes up is it turns into a kind of searching. Well, okay.
Yeah, you know, I just
looking
don't
know. For it.
Yeah. Then what you should...
Relax into that, I guess. That's what
you
do.
Yeah, that's what you should
do. But it's actually... Edward had this question at the beginning. I don't know if he was asking from the same perspective, but it was, you know...
Yeah.
Is there something you do? Is there an instruction you give yourself in a way? Or, you know...
Like, if you're... If that searching of the mind is there, then what I would suggest is don't worry about anything. You just relax the searching of the mind. Don't worry about it. Just relax that, relax that. And then you can, as you keep relaxing, you can notice what's there. Okay? And then don't worry about what you notice. You know, say what you notice what's there is that the mind's trying to not notice what's there, whatever. You know, you're going all kinds of things. Just be with it.
It's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, it's trying to do the right thing. So what I would say, don't worry about doing the right thing and do only this one thing of whatever the mind is doing is just relax. You relax doing that. So say the mind is searching around. Where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to see? Then you can say, you go ahead and have those thoughts. You just relax. Having those thoughts, relax.
And then it feels like nothing's happening.
Yeah, see, the mind.
Well, there is something happening. What is happening is that the mind is relaxing. That's what's happening.
But you see, the mind screams back and says, well, look, you've got to figure this out. If you figure this out, then you can relax.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that is what it does.
Well, that's good to know. You know what we need to do for this?
Yeah.
I understand. We need to do more, besides just teaching, because I think in teaching, hopefully things start, you know, click, and you start seeing things and see this. And so there's kind of a domino effect that takes place over time in terms of clarity. But maybe what we can do that I think is really kind of very helpful is japa. We'll do some japa together. And why that is helpful is because by the repetition of a mantra, what happens is that these thoughts are all taking place, right? But the differentiation between just the silent awareness and the thoughts become more pronounced through the doing japa. So I would say we've done it in here, so if you know how to do that, you can work it on your own, but we should do some in here together.
In a way, what was coming to mind is that's true of any practice, asana, pranayama, people who are artists, you know, when people are in a flow of immersive subject-object creativity or work, or you know, you experience that bliss or mind chatter is absent, and with, in my mind, these discussions inform those experiences very differently. Not just meaning, not just looking for the calmness of mind in Nididhyasana, but in so many other things we do that we love, or that bring us peace of mind.
That's true.
Otherwise, we identify with the practice as though somehow, you know, it removes the clinging to the practice. Like asana and all these things become sort of an end goal in themselves as though.
Yeah, rather than, that's true. That's very true. In fact, that's also, you know, when you do have a quiet mind or a peaceful mind or you're in the flow, you know, that's a good time to just, that's a good time to meditate, actually. Just to recognize. Yeah, because your mind's already in that state. Because you're engaged in something, or absorbed in something, or absorbed in nature. That's a beautiful time to just bring everything home. I'm teaching this relaxation exercise as something that when your mind is creating trouble for you, you know, just one thing, just simple thing in and of itself is just to relax. Just to allow the mind to relax, because you'll keep noticing that the bad negative affects have so much to do with just mental tension. And when you relax the mind, that tends to dissipate. And if that isn't working, then doing some inner child work where you actually talk to the mind and say, you know, this, I know you're worried, I know you're upset, and I understand that. Just give some, you know, positive feedback, it'll be all right, or whatever you say. You know, to just talk to the mind a little bit. Sometimes the mind needs that. And but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just enough to be present with those feelings and thoughts and just relax. Sometimes that's enough. But there's all different things, like doing this type of inner child work and, you know, where the complex or the hurt is so much, it just needs some words there. It needs a person there to tell it it's okay, to understand. That's why we do this inner, you know, this inner friend.
Yeah, that's all great, and I feel like I relax, and you know, I've actually grown a lot just from the practices here.
Yeah.
It's I just don't know what to do with relaxing to presence. It almost doesn't have a meaning for me.
Okay, that so that's okay, tangible. But the relaxed part has a meaning, but not
relax.
The relaxing to presence.
Yeah.
So just do the relaxed part. The other part will come naturally.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah. I promise you, it will, honestly,
okay.
Yeah.
So I don't need to worry about
you
it.
You don't need
just
to worry about it.
Keep relaxing and chill out.
Yeah, relax, chill out, do the inner child
enjoy
work.
Enjoy the pot smoke from all the dead.
And we should work on the japa. Japa is so beautiful, you know. It's actually made its way through so many spiritual disciplines and so many religions, this tilling of the beads, because there's something very profound about japa, to learn it. So we can practice. It'd be fun to practice together too, chanting together and things.
Well, in this Mandukya, does it talk about the, using the japa, or is it just definition of om?
It's not talking about japa in the Mandukya.
No.
But that's something that we know through so many ways, right? No, we're going to do this chapter 2, don't worry. It'll be good. Edward doesn't want to do the chapter 2. I think that chapter 2 will be good. If it's not any good, we don't like it, we can stop it.
What's the problem with chapter 2?
Yeah, what's the problem, Edward?
Well, right. I'll tell you
so
what it is, though.
Just printout you've given us, right, that ends at verse 28, there's a different book, or a separate printout that's going to come
from
the little book. Or...
Yeah, I've got to make another one. It can be a little heady, you know. It's a little heady. But it's only like 32 verses. And the way the verses are, we can do like easily maybe 3 verses at a time. Because that's not to race through. It's just that the verses come in sets. So we wouldn't do just one verse. We would do like 2 or 3 verses. And I was doing it.
And they're all about the 4 parts.
No. Now we're going to the second part. It's on mithya, understanding the mithyatva of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third chapter is understanding and all just circling around the vastu and Brahman. What is Brahman? What is the truth?
Yeah, I'm waiting for that set.
Yeah. But the thing is, to really understand what actually is, you have to negate all the things that you've taken to be the reality. That's just a kind of a teaching methodology.
Okay.
It'll be good.
I'm convinced.
It's strict drishta, right? I mean, it's distinguishing.
It's distinguishing and recognizing and understanding what we mean by mithya and the truth of mithya, you know? I think it'll be good. I think we should do it.
I think we should do it.
Yeah, we'll do it. We're going to do it. Edward will love it.
I'm already loving it.
I know. You are. Nobody loves it like you do, in fact.
I was sincere on
that.
Okay.
I'm in the city.
I mean, tonight.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan.